Welcome to Better Sex, where you get the information and inspiration to create and enjoy your best possible sex life. Join your host, sex therapist Jessa Zimmerman, as she brings you expert guests, helpful tips, knowledge, and strategies to improve your intimate relationships. And now, your host, Jessa Zimmerman.
Hey, everybody, it's Jessa. Welcome back to another episode of the Better Sex Podcast. I am so glad you're here with me. Thank you for taking the time and spending a little bit of your morning or afternoon or evening with me listening to the show. I'm actually recording from home today, so I apologize if there's construction noise from my neighborhood. This is where I've been set up to record lately. I've been really busy. I'm working on the next launch of my online course, which is based on my book, Sex Without Stress, same name. Anyway, by the time this airs, that will have been probably way in the past, but who knows, maybe I'm offering a new group any moment here. I'm having so much fun putting this course together, though, but it's a little overwhelming in terms of how much work it is trying to organize all the content. But in the midst of that, I took a break today to interview Doug Braun Harvey. Now, I'm going back to a topic that I have covered once before in the podcast, but way, way in the beginning. We're talking about out-of-control sexual behavior versus sex addiction. And Doug, since 1993, has been developing this treatment model and this whole conceptualization of out-of-control sexual behavior, meaning that they feel like their behavior and thoughts and desires are out of control. And it's a problem, but it is not a disease. It's not pathological. It's not a disorder. And this is a controversial idea right now. There's different schools of thought about this. There's all kinds of discussion about how to categorize these issues. But he comes down squarely with the concept of sexual health and what principles that involves and what's important about that and why some of this behavior is a problem from that perspective that can be treated as such with the clients. And if you're out listening to this and you have any question at all about your own thoughts, desires, or behavior, you've wondered if it's out of control or healthy or normal, this is a conversation for you. He literally wrote the book on treating out of control sexual behavior, rethinking sex addiction. It's a really important conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Doug, thank you so much for being with me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I looked over your podcast history and you interview a wide breadth of people and you provide a great deal of information to a lot of people. And I'm just glad to be part of that.
Well, thank you. I think we have to start with the whole idea of sexual health, right? Because it's such the foundation of your approach. So I would love for you to define that, I guess, or talk about the concept for people.
Well, the definition, there's 30 or more definitions of sexual health throughout the planet. So there's a lot of different sexual health specific definitions. Two in particular, the World Health Organization in 2006 and the Pan American Health Organization in 2000. There are two macro definitions of sexual health that have been sort of seminal, as well as the U.S. Surgeon General's definition of sexual health that came out in the Surgeon General's report in the early 2000s. And I think sexual health really has three narratives that are essential to understand sexual health. Sexual health is a balance between sexual safety and sexual pleasure. So you're in the realm of sexual health when you're not just exclusively focused on the risks, the consequences, the negative outcomes of sexual life, but you're also focused on the pleasure and the benefits and the deeply meaningful components of sexual life.
Yeah.
So sexual health is this balance between pleasure and safety. And so oftentimes you're aware that you're involved in a sexual health conversation when pleasure is inextricably linked to part of the whole conversation.
Which is not what happens in sex ed, for instance, right?
Like that. Right. That's right. That's right. The pleasure that, you know, you're in a sexual health conversation when pleasure is essentially required to be balanced with the safety and responsibility components of sexual life.
Yeah.
And so they're in the conversation with equivalent proportions of importance. And then the third narrative, so you have safety, pleasure, and then protecting the sexual rights of people when you're involved in sexual activity. There's 16 sexual rights established by the World Association of Sexual Health. I'm not going to get into all those.
Okay.
You can just Google sexual rights and you'll find all 16 of them. But this is why I used the World Health Organization definition from 2006, was they expanded upon their definition of sexual health and included protection of sexual rights in addition to balance, safety, and pleasure. Now, just to lay the context of that, just historically, sexual health prior to the mid-1970s, that may sound like ancient history, but it's not that long ago,
right.
Sexual health meant two things, pretty much in the world, that you did not have an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy,
right,
and you did not acquire a sexually transmitted infection. Those two things were kind of the entire preoccupation for sexual health on the planet. Huh. So basically, if you didn't get knocked up and you didn't get the clap, you were good to go.
Right. And that must have been what formed like sex ed, like I was saying, right? That was the extent, really, of what I learned in school.
Right. Right. Well, that still remains the central focus of almost all sex education in the United States.
Yeah.
Is let's deal with, you know, pregnancy, and let's deal with sexually transmitted infections. And once you get beyond those areas of focus, much of the controversy of sex education in our country starts to unfold.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you incorporate the pleasure, as you said, into sex education, you are really involved in a very controversial and very difficult kind of transaction to what to do with the pleasure when you're trying to educate people about sex.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess without a whole history lesson, like if that was the story in the 70s, how do we get to the 2000s where all these world organizations are starting to recognize pleasure and the importance of that?
Yeah. Well, what happened was they began to realize that was too narrow of a definition. I think the HIV worldwide epidemic had a significant influence on the importance of sex education because there was a disease that killed people we had no cure for, and the only way to prevent it was to have more candid and specific conversations about sex.
Yeah.
And so when it wasn't pregnancy prevention, but it was actually viral transmission and at the time, a deadly virus,
right?
You had to kind of rethink these limitations on what we mean by sexual health. I think the women's rights movement, other rights movements, and sexual orientation diversity started to become an emerging issue in conjunction with HIV and AIDS. And then the advent of the internet and, you know, information not being so closely regulated by radio and television and commercial interests, but actually being regulated by more grassroots access to behavior dissemination. And so all of this kind of...
It all sort of came together, right?
Yeah. It synergistically affects each other.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the conversation about out of control sexual behavior, I mean, I was looking at, you know, some of your material, and you're talking about there were sort of two different ways people tended to frame this behavior, and that you really come in with a sexual health perspective on it. Would you speak to that?
Right. I think for anybody listening to the podcast, there's a particular question you'd have to ask yourself, whether you're a consumer or whether you're somebody who might be professionally helping people. Do you think sexual behavior that can be out of control, dysregulated, people can have problems with how they conduct their sexual lives, do you believe that that actually can become a disease, a disorder, or pathology? Do you think that's actually part of what this is? Or do you think this can actually just be really considered more of a human behavior problem? Problems are not disorders. The clearest example of a sexual problem is affairs. You know, people don't keep their sexual agreements. They don't follow through with the agreements they've made in sexual relationships. That's a problem.
Right.
Now, is it a disease or a pathology? No.
Uh-huh.
But it's certainly more than just a worry. You know, like, does my hair look good for the date tonight? You know, I mean, you know, that's a worry. But, you know, problems are a little bit more severe. So I think this is a central question everybody has to ask. Do I think this is a problem, or do I think this is actual pathology or disorder or disease?
Yeah.
And there are some people who really believe it's a disorder or disease. And there are two primary kind of ideas about sexual behavior as a disease that have really had prominence. The most prominent language and model is sex addiction, where the idea that out of control or dysregulated sexual behavior is actually part of an addictive process, and that there are actual things that go on in the body and in the mind that are synonymous with sort of other kind of addictive disorders, more likely like substance abuse or other or gambling or, you know, things like that. Process addiction versus a, you know, a chemical addiction. And so sex addiction is one of them. The other one is compulsive or impulsive behavior. There's a sense that maybe for some people the disorder is they have a compulsion or they have an impulse control problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting is the World Health Organization has a classification system for diseases and disorders of every kind known by mankind. They have this classification system. It's called the ICD, International Classification of Disorders. And their newest edition, which is the 11th edition, has decided to classify what we call compulsive sexual, what they call compulsive sexual behavior, under an impulse control disorder of a psychiatric condition.
Okay.
So they're saying compulsive sexual behavior is one of the ways people with an impulse control disorder behave.
Okay.
And that we're going to call that compulsive sexual behavior.
Right.
And this is, there's really no research specifically on this. What the ICD does is they actually create classifications in the hope that it'll be studied more rigorously because they've created a classification.
So they name it first and then wait to see if it really...
Well, at least there was sufficient science for them to say, let's look into this, right?
So, okay, but and they obviously came down on that side versus the addiction. Something's happening.
That's right. That's right. They so both the psychiatric and diagnostic manual, the DSM, and the ICD have come down on the idea that there is insufficient evidence to support that sexual behavior is an addictive process or can become an addictive process. That so one side, the ICD says perhaps it's part of an impulse control condition that's a psychiatric condition that some people have. And they're actually also not saying there's all sorts of rule outs for that diagnosis. So it can't be because of a religious conflict. It can't be because of a values conflict. You know, it can't be attributable to another disorder. You know, so they basically said, if you're going to have compulsive sexual behavior, it can't be explained. All these other situations have to be, you know, understood first before we can conclude it's compulsive sexual behavior.
Yeah.
Now, this is the first time any diagnostic or, you know, classification system has said, wait a minute, we're going to slow down and not address this and call it compulsive sexual behavior until we've ruled out the religious and moral conflicts that a person may have about their sexual behavior. And we're not going to call a moral conflict a compulsive sexual behavior. That's a moral conflict, not an impulse control disorder.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm thinking, you know, somebody with impulse control issues, that would be showing up in other places too. Like if all you were doing was having affairs, you know, but you can control your impulses in all kinds of other ways.
That's also one of the other things around this diagnosis that's somewhat controversial is can we really kind of isolate that an impulse control disorder with, you know, kind of a compulsive behavior is specific to their sexual behavior, and it really doesn't show up anywhere else,
in a
pathological kind of threshold way.
Yeah.
This is why the classification system is so important to study, but this is also one of the critiques that I and others in the field really have for the disease conceptualization, is there is so much cultural risk of bias in these threshold cut points of what the disorder versus a non-disorder distinction. And I don't think we've established enough differentiation between a real understanding of a disorder versus a kind of a subjective analysis of a disorder too much imbued by cultural biases around sexual behavior. Now, one of the areas that's been studied that really helps us see this clearly is in the last 5 years, Joshua Grubbs and other researchers have really been looking at this idea of porn addiction.
Yeah.
As a subset of kind of a sexual addiction. And they've really been looking at people who self-describe as, I'm a porn addict. Mm-hmm. And even clinicians who endorse the idea of a porn addiction. And what they have found is the subset of people who most identify as porn addicts are people with high religious conflicts about looking at sexual imagery and masturbating.
Yeah.
And so when they have this conflict that's a moral or religious conflict, they are rescued from this terrible bind.
Yeah.
By saying they have a disease.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly hear that from clients too, who sure wish their history of affairs could be explained by some sort of disease, right?
Right, right. Yeah, there's something appealing about that, right? We are held in less moral judgment when we have a disease. Now, this is actually progress because, you know, alcoholism and mental illness used to be all seen as a moral failure.
Right.
But, you know, and then sexual behaviors were seen as perversions.
Yeah.
So actually having a disease rather than being a perversion was
actually a step up
and a progress.
Right, right.
And so now we're really questioning the disordered spectrum of certain sexual and erotic diversity.
Yeah.
Is this really too imbued with bias and subjective judgments about what sexual activity is acceptable or not?
I'm sitting here as a therapist and thinking about how I think about couples and behavior and sexuality and intimacy, and thinking there are a lot of rule outs in my mind, not just, you know, religious conflict or moral conflict. There's intimacy. There's innumerable things that can explain or influence this behavior, it seems to me, before you get to a point of saying this is somehow pathological.
I completely agree with you that we don't even know all of the possible contributors.
Yeah.
That would lead to somebody saying, I'm a sex addict, or I have a compulsive sexual behavior, or I have out of control sexual behavior. And that, unfortunately, many of the clinicians and the therapists who are, you know, being asked to address these concerns have minimal training in human sexuality.
Yeah.
Particularly, it's important to note that the certification to be a sex addiction therapist, which is a certification issued by a for-profit company, they train in a specific method and model of sex addiction treatment.
Right.
And you get certification. And this certification, which is extensive training, and people spend a great deal of time and professional investment in this training, but the training requires no training in human sexuality.
Wow.
To be a certified sex addiction therapist. Now, they could get additional human sexuality training, but the certification process itself requires no additional training in human sexuality to be a certified sex addiction therapist.
Wow.
So that's somebody who specializes in working with this population. Then we have the general mental health field and the sexual literacy within the general mental health field. I think we have to be honest with ourselves. The sexual literacy within the mental health field is actually quite low.
Right.
And it's not all that different than the general society at large.
Yeah.
And so if a mental health professional wants to be more trained in human sexuality, they tend to have to go out and seek that and really invest in it.
Right, right. Well, and as we know, you know, to get certified with ASECT as a sex therapist, such an important part of that is that sexuality attitudes reassessment, right? Where we're looking at our own biases and our edges and our misinformation and challenging ourselves in that way. It's such an important part of training.
It really is.
People are dealing with this without having necessarily questioned their belief systems is kind of mind-boggling.
Well, I just think from a consumer perspective, it's very important to know that when you're sitting with a therapist who's maybe wanting to help you with out-of-control sexual behavior, you really have to kind of understand what is their training.
Mm-hmm.
And how much training do they have in human sexuality?
Right.
I was in a training in a southern, I think it was Texas, and there were about maybe 50, 75 therapists in the room. And one of the person referred to a certified sex addiction therapist as a sex therapist. And And they had no misunderstanding about that. I mean, they really thought a sex addiction therapist was a sex therapist.
Right.
I clarify, those are two different things.
Right.
And that, I think that was really an eye opener for me.
Yeah.
That even our people in our field, people who are coming to a training on how to control sexual behavior. I mean, this is a very small subset of the mental health professionals, and they carried that information as if that was an accurate, piece of information. So, you know, good, accurate sexual information, knowledge is not easy to come by in our culture.
Right, right. Okay, so speak about how do you view, you know, how do you describe or explain or conceptualize, I guess, out of control sexual behavior?
Well, we define, and I say we, Michael Vigorito and I are based on our book, Treating Out of Control Sexual Behavior, Rethinking Sex Addiction. We defined out of control sexual behavior, what we call OCSB, is when it's a sexual health problem in which a person's sexual urges, thoughts, or behaviors feel out of control to them.
Okay.
So this is a client-centered model. So the client has this experience of feeling out of control. That's their experience of themselves.
Okay.
And there's a couple of very important parameters around this. First of all, this definition of OCSB applies only to consensual sexual behavior. So it's for consensual sexual behavior, not non-consensual sexual behavior. It's a sexual health problem. So that's the primary difference of our definition and our model versus these other disease models. We see it as a sexual health problem, not a disease or a disorder. So
okay.
We're in the problem range of human behavior and a sexual health problem. And I'll describe in a minute what I mean by a sexual health problem. So it's a sexual health problem of consensual thoughts, urges, or behaviors that to the individual feel out of control. So, you know, the client themselves has this subjective experience of feeling out of control.
Yeah.
And as a sex therapist and author and trainer, Marty Klein says, just because somebody feels out of control doesn't mean they are out of control.
Yes, as I tell clients all the time, your feelings are valid, but it doesn't mean they're accurate.
Right, that's right. And so our model is really based on the idea that there is this subjective experience. It's very real for people to feel out of control.
Yeah.
Now, we have a theory of human behavior that we found from psychology that really helps explain this. It's in our book, and we talk about it. I don't want to go into theory too much here, but there's actual, you know, theories of human behavior that support this as seen as a problem. The beauty of when you look at a human condition as not a disease or a disorder, the whole world of psychology and understanding human behavior opens up to us because we don't need to look at it only through what would a pathology look like?
Yeah.
We're not held up to the standard of this is what a disorder would look like. We just want to know what human behavior is.
Yeah.
And we studied human behavior from such a wide range. We found a theory of human behavior that really helped us understand this idea. And so how we understand out of control sexual behavior is a person's kind of affective and thinking world, which is kind of how humans are made up. We have all these emotions and drives, and we have thoughts and ideas, and they all have to intermix somehow.
Right.
And human behavior results. And our idea is that when somebody has sexual behavior that's out of control, their sexual behavior is not aligned with six principles of sexual health. And that's why we call this a sexual health model. So the six principles of sexual health come from these definitions of sexual health. And the six principles are that sexual health is consensual, non-exploitive, is protected from HIV, STIs, and unplanned or unwanted pregnancy, honesty, shared values, and pleasure and mutual pleasure. So those are the six principles of sexual health. So our method, our idea of working with the problem of sexual behavior feeling out of control is we work with, and I'm going to specifically say now men, because our model has only been utilized and implemented with men, men who identify cisgender. So this is not a model that clinically has been worked with in any way to the degree it has. I've been doing this since 1993 with men, but not, so I'm going to speak to men, and that's intentional because that's who I can do from my clinical experience, is that when men align their lives with these six principles of sexual health, it's incompatible with out-of-control sexual behavior. You can't have out of control sexual behavior and align your life with these six principles of sexual health. And so we work with men to teach them about these sexual health principles, and then help them develop a personal vision of sexual health that is first and foremost founded upon making sure their sexual life involves sexual consent, is non-exploitive, is protected from these, you know, viruses and unwanted pregnancies and bacteria, has a degree of honesty that they feel is sufficient enough for them to feel within their values and how to be an honest person, that there are shared values, that the people they have sex with and the people they're making agreements with around sexuality have similar enough values to engage in sexual activity and have some agreement of what the meaning of this sexual activity is, and that the sexual activity involves pleasure and that everybody's pleasure,
right?
And that it is a pleasurable experience. So when those become the foundational framework and you're really committed to having your life be more and more operationalized within those principles, it's incompatible to have your life be out of control sexually.
Hi, it's Jessa here, taking just a quick break. Thanks for listening so far. I wanted to let you know about the sex quiz that I've put together called How Healthy Is Your Sex Life? I've taken a close look at the typical ways that I see couples get into trouble with sex, including avoidance, neglect, negativity, distraction, and boredom. And the free quiz will score your individual results based on these factors. And then I provide my recommendations and ideas, including my top 10 sex tips, which will help you make instant improvement. If you'd like to take the quiz and see how healthy your sex life is, you can do it right now at sexhealthquiz.com. So I have a couple of thoughts. So one of them is somebody who feels like they are addicted to or out of control with masturbation. A lot of those elements, I have a hard time seeing how those sexual health principles then free that person from their own moral conflict around that.
Let me give you an example. I work with men who are recovering from crystal meth addiction, and that's very high sex drug-like drugs. So they're under the influence of crystal, and they're almost always using crystal meth in a sexual situation. So I have men who are in recovery from crystal meth addiction, but they go online to live sex sites where there's a camera in a room and men are using crystal meth and having sex with each other. It's a live cam sex site.
Yeah.
They'll go and watch those scenes and masturbate to orgasm, where they get to relive their crystal sex scenes by exploiting current crystal meth users.
Yeah. Right.
That's an exploitation.
Yeah.
You're taking advantage of an active crystal meth user. And they know more than anybody the devastation of crystal meth use and what it wreaks on someone's life. And they're actually using their active crystal meth addiction for their orgasmic pleasure.
Yeah.
They have to ask themselves how they feel about this.
Right. And what about somebody that just struggles with, whether it's religious or not, you know, believing masturbation is wrong, but they're masturbating, and so they're feeling out of control with that behavior. But there's...
They may be feeling out of control, but the source of being out of control is they have not faced and resolved an essential conflict in their life.
Yeah.
They have a religion that has one particular way of understanding solo sex, and they have an experience of solo sex that's probably pleasurable.
Right.
That's why they're doing it.
Yeah.
Now, what do you do? What do you do when something pleasurable and enjoyable in your life conflicts with your religious and moral code? How do you resolve that? When it's this something as typical and average human behavior, such as solo sex. It's the most common sexual activity on the planet.
Yeah.
So what do you do? I mean, a person has to sit in the room and figure out how they're going to resolve this conflict, but they don't resolve the conflict by calling that a disorder.
Yeah.
A moral conflict is not a disease.
Right.
But still a moral conflict.
Yes. And so do you find with the clients that you work with that out of these six principles, there's one or two that they are sort of tripped up with? And if they can embrace those, I mean, I'm imagining most people aren't flailing with all six, right? So I do have some people,
I think rather than maybe most common, I'm going to call the most significant to pay attention to.
Okay.
The one that I think mental health professionals are not as well trained to address is what happens if somebody walks into your office and they're involved in some non-consensual sexual activity. It's never been discovered.
Yeah.
They've never been arrested. But some non-consensual activity is emerging in the clinical room.
Yeah.
Excuse me. This is an area of little training.
Yeah.
For mental health professionals. We are trained to respond to the other continuum of non-consent. We are highly trained oftentimes to work with people who have been the target of non-consent.
Right.
Either in childhood or, you know, in their development or in sometimes either through sexual assault or incest or, you know, sexual abuse or
right.
a wide range of non-consensual sexual activities. But we're not very trained to deal with people who are the actors of non-consent.
Right.
So that's an important one. And I think every therapist needs to ask themselves the question, if somebody were to reveal non-consensual sexual activity that's currently part of their life, what is my response as a clinician? Now, some states have different laws to mandate what a mental health professional has to do at those times. I don't want to get into those nuances. But I think the first question is, am I somebody who's capable of assessing and developing a treatment plan for that, or do I need to refer them to what I call a non-consensual specialist?
Right.
There are therapists and licensed mental health professionals highly trained in working with non-consent. And those are the people I think are the only people who should be assessing non-consent.
Yes.
Because they're trained.
Yeah, because you said even your model is for consensual sexual behavior.
That's right.
Yeah.
So if somebody shows up in my office for an initial screening and it looks like they're involved in non-consent, I have a non-consensual specialist. I work here in San Diego who I refer them to. And I trust the non-consensual person to tell me if they're an appropriate candidate for my treatment or they should be in the treatment program for the non-consent. That's
right.
I think they're in a better position to make that call than I am.
Yeah, yeah.
So consent's a big one. Exploitation is one that I find gets confused a lot in the mental health field. The mental health field thinks that non-consent is a far more pervasive concept than I think it is. I think non-consent needs to be reserved for the violation of another person through a sexual act or activity. When I mean violation, like, you know, they're impacting directly the body or the psyche of another person.
Right.
The immediate person. Oftentimes, mental health professionals call breaking a relationship agreement, violating a relationship agreement as non-consent. That's exploitation.
Okay.
When you make an agreement in a relationship, I'm only going to have sex with you, and then you go off and don't keep that agreement, but then don't tell the person you broke the agreement,
right.
And you keep acting as if you did keep the agreement, that's exploiting. You
yeah.
have information, and you're not sharing that information, and you're actually exploiting the fact that this other person still believes the contract is in effect.
Right, right.
That's exploitation. That's not non-consent.
Yeah.
You're not forcing sex on that person
yeah.
that you're in this relationship agreement. You might be. There's marital rape. I mean, a relationship rape. It can happen.
Right.
But that's different than exploitation.
Yeah.
I think couples therapists are at the forefront of dealing with the fact that people get into relationships and they exploit each other.
Yes.
And nobody likes to think about that.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's a tough thing to cop to, you know, in the room. So,
well, I think it's a human behavior.
Yes,
that unfortunately has been so shamed that to be honest about it means having to feel terrible, terrible shame, and it's
right.
unfortunate because
right.
exploitation is a very common human behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what's the basic approach, or I mean, I don't know if you've got a system and people are going through steps or you know, but what's the
yes,
basic,
we do.
What's the basic approach back to sexual health for somebody that's showing up like in your office?
Well, the first thing we do is we do a one-time screening appointment. So a client calls and we'll just say the only thing you have to commit to at this point is a one-time screening. And that's really to just, you know, have a private place where they can speak separately from, it only involves the man who has the concern. We don't meet with partners in that appointment. And it's specifically the man. This is a very self-motivational program. So the man himself has to be wanting to come in and talk about their problem. We rule out four areas of acuity. We want to make sure there's not a physical safety issue that is really serious. We want to make sure there's not a mental illness issue, a psychiatric condition that's not been adequately treated at all. We don't want to make sure there's not a drug and alcohol relationship that is really serious and could interfere with any treatment. And we want to make sure there's not a medical condition that could really affect, you know, whether or not this person is going to be able to be adequately assessed. So we want to make sure those things aren't so acute that it would be irresponsible of us to continue with an OCSB assessment with that level of a condition going untreated or unaddressed. Mm-hmm. So that's really part of the screening appointment. It doesn't mean you can't have some depression and go through the OCSB assessment.
Right, right.
We just don't want them to be suicidal, you know,
yeah.
And you know, I mean, so there's the acuity levels, the issue here.
Yeah.
And then, so we do the one-time screening appointment. If the client and the therapist agree to move forward, then we do an assessment. And our assessment is really quite involved. It's a semi-structured interview process. So the client fills out measures and we kind of talk about the measures they fill out, but we're also preparing them through the process of the assessment. We're preparing them to be a client in OCSB treatment.
Right.
Men don't know how to walk off the street and have a sexual health conversation.
Yeah.
You know, men don't know how to speak accurately and without being flooded with shame about a sex act they engage in that's important for them to talk about. Men don't necessarily know how to think about sexual health as a destination for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think in our culture, most men's sexual lives are of little interest until they've injured somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're kind of interested in men's sexual lives if they've been a sex offender, if they've been a victim of sexual abuse, or if they're a sex addict.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of three ways we're interested in the sexual lives of men. Beyond that, men are pretty much on their own until they hurt somebody.
Yeah. Sad state of affairs.
Yes. And so I like to kind of think of this assessment as an opportunity for a man to begin to have their sexual world be respected, be interested in, without it having to be a disease.
Yeah.
And that these men have a right to develop and define their vision of sexual health. And men are really not asked to do this. They're kind of told who they're supposed to be sexually, not necessarily what their vision is.
What's striking me as you're saying this is thinking about how some people, some men, I think come in hoping it's a disease, right? Like it's an alleviation of responsibility, or it excuses them from the shame or something like that.
Actually, I don't agree with either of those narratives.
Oh, okay.
I think the disease rescues people from losing attachments.
Hmm.
If you're a sex addict, somebody might stay in the marriage.
Right, right. But what I'm struck by is
treatment for that disease, somebody might have hope that they can change.
But it's still It's still such a disservice to them, though, to have a disease model as opposed to an invitation into ownership and sexual health and the ability to.
I think that's a narrative that works later on. That's a disservice. I think first we have to look at how it serves them to have the disease.
Yeah.
Maybe they get to not have their marriage severed, so they get to raise their children.
Yeah.
That's not a small deal.
No, it's not.
Right? So if having this disease idea hang around for a while allows things to settle down and somebody doesn't have an impulsive severing response that affects intergenerationally the lives of children for the next 70 years, I don't think that's okay. I'll live with it for a year. If they think they need to have a disease, we got to look at the big picture here. Most of the men that come in often will think of themselves as having a sex addiction. And I don't argue with them.
Oh, okay. So you're not, okay. So that's not something you're tackling right up front with them, that you've got this different conceptualization. Okay.
Well, they'll see I have a different conceptualization because I'll tell them what I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't expect them to have to think it.
Okay.
This is their world, for God's sake. They're trying to figure out a whole lot of things here, and it's not up to me to decide, you know, what narrative is the one that gives them the most hope.
Right, right.
But I work a certain way.
Yeah.
So I stand up for how I work. And most of the men, some leave because they want a sex addiction treatment program. Okay. But most of the men we see call me or are us because they've read something that I've written. They've heard something I've said. They already think differently, and they've just been looking for somebody who will help them with their sexual problem that isn't somebody who will make them have a sex addiction.
Right.
So there's lots of different motives people come.
Yeah.
But some people want the addiction model, and okay, I know who to send them to, and I'll send them to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an alternative model,
not
the model.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are different ways to address different human conditions.
Yeah.
So I'm more interested in the alternative. So the men come and they want this alternative. And I find that the biggest motive for men wanting this alternative method is they just don't think they have a sex addiction.
Yeah.
But they do have a problem.
Right.
And they want their problem taken seriously without having to have a disorder. They like that.
Yeah. Okay, so you work with them to find, I think you said, figure out their vision of sexual health for themselves. Right.
And so obviously, and so the end of that vision of sexual health is a sexual health plan. So at the end of the assessment process, we develop what we call a sexual health plan, where it's three columns, and one of the columns is their boundaries. So they determine through this assessment process and coming to terms with the right things, these are the sexual behaviors that are boundaries for me that I don't want to cross. And then the middle column is areas they're ambivalent about. They're not sure they want to make boundaries, or, you know, maybe they're just sexual behaviors that they're conflicted about, but they don't want to make it a boundary to not engage in it or to engage in it. This is really where solo sex lands a lot of times, if solo sex is not the out of control behavior. And then in the middle column might also be things that might, if they engage in those activities, might put them at risk for crossing their boundaries.
Okay.
You know, so like somebody might put on their smoking pot, because they usually always cross their boundaries when they smoke pot. So
right.
They might, you know, really be looking at their relationship with cannabis and see, you know, how that might relate to their sexual decision making. And then the third column is the sexual health column. Here's their vision.
Yeah.
You know, here's who I want to be sexually. Here's how I want to be interpersonally. This is the way I take care of myself, my self-care. This is the kinds of treatment or therapies I might engage in to change my life. It's all about health. These are all my health behavior changes that I'm going to do. And then when they have that written sexual health plan, then we sort of give them at the end of the assessment process their recommendations for treatment. We provide individual and group treatment in our program. Couples therapy might be indicated, medication therapy, psychiatric treatment might be recommended to maintain it. Maybe they already have a psychiatrist, keep doing that. You know, we might recommend a variety of other things.
Right.
But what we provide is the individual and group therapy. And to be in the groups we provide, our men with out of control sexual behavior, our sexual health groups, requires to be in individual therapy. So everybody in the group has to be in individual therapy. It doesn't have to be with us, but they have to be in individual therapy at least once a month. Usually the men are in individual therapy a little more frequently than that.
Yeah.
So our fundamental model, if they're in our full model, is both group and individual therapy combined.
Right. So how do people find this kind of help? I mean, you're in San Diego,
and
I know that you train people because I'm, you know, I've got a colleague here that's worked with you. And so in Seattle, we have people too.
Mm-hmm.
But where do people find appropriate, if this is what they're interested in, and if they embrace this conceptualization, where do they go?
Well, you know, there isn't a system set up as elegantly as the certified sex addiction therapy field is set up. We don't aspire to creating certification for OCSB therapists.
Okay.
Right. As long as I'm around, there's not going to be a certification for this. I don't think good sexological training, unless you want to be a specialist in sex therapy, requires certification.
Yeah.
I think it requires good psychotherapy and good training.
Yeah.
And so I think if somebody's interested in this model and they're a client listening to this, or you want to find somebody, I think you would use the phrase OCSB.
Okay.
Do you treat OCSB? Do you work with out-of-control sexual behavior? If you use the phrase sex addiction, you will get a therapist who is a certified sex addiction therapist. You might get a therapist who's not necessarily well-trained or has significantly trained themselves in this area, but they're familiar with the phrase sex addiction. And they might say, well, okay, I work with that. So sex addiction either can be a specific clinical modality, or it can be the only language the client knows.
Right, sort of a catch-all.
Right. So you got to be clear on this. So if you're going to call and ask around, you've got to say, do you work with out-of-control sexual behavior? It is becoming the terminology that implies a non-pathology approach to this human behavior.
Right. To a sexual health problem as opposed to
right. Pathology. Yeah. So okay. if you use OCSB or out-of-control sexual behavior, you're going to, and the therapist goes, oh yeah. You're going to probably be having a therapist who will see it more as a problem instead of a disease.
Right. I say that's a great idea. It's sort of a little bit of a litmus test, right? Does somebody even know if they heard that term? Did they embrace that term? It's,
yeah. Right. And I can tell you, if a therapist has been to one of my trainings, or Michael Zavigarito's in my trainings, or other therapists who train in this model, the therapist is going to be thrilled to have somebody ask about that.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Wow. You know about that? I mean, maybe in 10 years it won't be so the same, but not right now. It's still an anomaly to have somebody call up and say, do you work with OCSB?
Right. So anything else, just to wrap up, that you want to let people know about, you know, you, your resources, you know, where can people learn a little bit more?
Well, I have a company called the Harvey Institute. And that's my website, theharveyinstitute.com. At the Harvey Institute, you can find chapters I've written on various aspects of out-of-control sexual behavior in different publications. We're in the Goop sex issue. we're in the International Handbook on Sex Addiction under the chapter of alternative models. I wrote a chapter in the Art of Sex Therapy Supervision. Book, and that's on group supervision. So I talk about my group methods and working with professionals there. So if you're interested in that, that's there. I have videos where I've given much more extensive, you know, discussions about the model. You can find at the website.
Okay, great.
And also trainings that I do throughout the world on out-of-control sexual behavior. I'll be training in Dublin in September of this year, and I'll be training in outside of Atlanta, Georgia, Duluth, Georgia. In October, and in November I'll be training in West Palm Beach, Florida, and you can get more information about this at the Harvey Institute website.
And I assume all the trainings are for mental health professionals.
Yes.
Okay.
All of the trainings are for mental health professionals. You know, these are people that are, you know, providing outpatient therapy and are interested in how to screen and assess. Most of the people who come to the trainings aren't going to become specialists in OCSB. But they certainly want to become more familiar with how to assess this, how to integrate it more effectively into maybe their couples therapy or their individual therapy. And there may be people in your community who are providing specialized services in OCSB, and you could be the individual therapist while they go to the group work that these professionals are providing.
Right. Great. Well, thank you so much for having this whole conversation with me.
Oh, it just flew by.
I know, it goes by. So
and I really appreciate your questions, and I really appreciate you kind of knowing your audience and what might be a particular focus that they'd be interested in hearing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Better Sex. Please visit our website, bettersexpodcast.com, for show notes and additional episodes.
And that's a wrap for today. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are enjoying the podcast, if some of this material resonates with you and you would like to make a difference and make sure that this keeps coming out in the world once a week, ongoing, there are a couple things you could do to show your appreciation. The first would be to go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That really helps us be found by new listeners when you review the show on iTunes. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/iTunes. The other thing I want to invite you to consider is becoming a Patreon. For a small monthly pledge, you get some benefits. So for $2 a month, you get advance access to every single episode. For $5 a month, you get a chapter of my upcoming new book. And for $10 a month, I host quarterly get to know you and question and answer chats over the web, and you get invited to that. I would love to have your membership in that. Become part of the Better Sex family. You can find a link at bettersexpodcast.com/Patreon, which is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Again, thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here. Feel free to comment, ask questions, get in touch. I'd love to hear from listeners. Thanks.